Please be advised, this episode contains stories of emotional and spiritual manipulation, as well as some other forms of abuse that some listeners may find upsetting. Listen at your own discretion.
It's absolutely powerful. The further in you go, the more questioning any little thing means that the whole thing is a damn house of cards. And all of these things that you did mean nothing. And yeah, they mean that you just hurt somebody a lot. For what? And so what, are you going to question those little things? Because it's going to question everything. And it's hard. And it's powerful.
Today, I am excited to bring you the highly anticipated second part of my conversation with Darren, who found himself living as a member of a small cult right after graduating from this really renowned Christian university. If you've not already done so, I recommend you highly that you listen to the first episode of Darren's story to understand the process of how he ended up in this situation that he's sharing with us today. Just as the last time that we heard from Darren, I want to strongly recommend that we all listen to his story first and foremost with empathy. Because the question is not really whether or not we're going to face some of the challenges in our own lives, but to what extent. We do, we already have, and we will face these kinds of situations again. If we aren't facing them right now, they're just going to be maybe to a different extent and in different ways. So let's return to Darren's story as he picks up counting a pivotal moment in his decision to become more deeply involved with this really small group and their increasingly controlling leader, as well as the extent to which that controlling power is going to impact and shape Darren's life and choices. Hi, I'm Doug Harrison, and you're listening to The Heartburn.
I'll tell you the other half of it, though, which was that right around the corner from where I was on the landline, he was on instant messenger with my brother, telling him that I had just been singing that song and that he needed to bring that up to me. So this wasn't a coincidence at all. This was a manufactured coincidence.
So, and at this point, there's no question about the monstrosity.
Right! It was absolutely monstrous. Like to completely manipulate somebody's spiritual experience in that way, with utter cynicism and contempt for anything holy and good. You are just saying, I don't care if God does this. I'm God if I want to be. I'm going to manufacture this and make it happen. In cult studies, that's usually called mystical manipulation. That term comes from Robert J. Lifton, who did a lot of seminal work on this. And that is exactly what that was. And it was, you know, deeply hurtful in the end, right? Like, this was just sort of a created moment. And so from that moment then, I truly believed that this was what I was going to do. I did not know what the hell to do with that. Let me just bring you back to the moment. I was getting married in August. It was May. June, July, August. That's 3 months away. Okay? I had to fly back to wherever I was to my job that I had just gotten in February because my future father-in-law suggested that I get a job so I could marry his daughter and figure out how to quit my job or put it on hold while I go overseas. Or what am I doing? I have no idea. How am I going to do this? So this is why I say that was the outer edge of the event horizon, because at this point I'm like, this is, whoa, what is going on? But I'm at least for the moment committed. So then I get on the plane home and I'm like, what just happened? And it starts to sort of fade into my memory a bit. This is, you know, I'll think about this later. So I get back home and that was the beginning of the week. I try to put it out of my mind and just sort of forget about all about it. Like, let's just get back to life, guys. You know, like, whew, glad that's over. Man, that guy is pretty friggin' intense. Friday rolls around, he's been sending me voice messages, you know, in and out for the last few days. I was mostly ignoring them. Friday, somehow I end up picking the phone up. I don't remember why or when or how, but I'm talking to him and I don't even know how to explain exactly what happened, but it's essentially, I really believe, the equivalent of like a post-hypnotic suggestion, you know, where he really, really kept pressing me that, no, man, you made this commitment. We need you here. The team needs you. We're going overseas. It's not the same without you. He said, it's like a fire, like a bonfire, you know, that you take a log out of the bonfire and it's, the log is not on fire and the fire is not the same. And like, we need you here. And so I decided I would go. It was crazy because I called the airport. I don't remember if I got online or what I did. I mean, that wasn't a big thing then. But I looked at everything I could look at, and there were no flights available. But he was like, no, we need you for Saturday morning. There's a Saturday morning service here. We need you here to pray with the team. They're going to anoint us. I went to the airport, and it was one of these, it was like in like a romantic comedy or something, but like sort of like the dark dystopian version of a romantic comedy where they go and they're like, I need the next flight to wherever, you know? Oh yeah, sure. Suddenly somehow there's a flight, you know? And so there was. And so I got a flight from, you know, somewhere in the west of the country to somewhere in the east of the country, ping-ponging around to different cities to get there. And I made it. By the next morning, by the service, there was a very tearful goodbye to my fiance at the time. She was totally shattered. She was like, how did I make this mistake in your character? Like, how did I choose this person? What happened here? And you know, we sort of said goodbye at the airport, and it was terrible. And I left things just like that. I was sort of renting out a room in one of the church families' homes, and I just sort of left it, all my stuff there. I'm gonna go, you know. And I told her at the time, look, it's just for the summer. I will come back. We'll get married. We'll sort it all out. We'll figure it out from here. I'm not leaving you, but I did make a commitment to God that, again, I had this moment where my brother had the same thing going on as me. I'm like, this had like this seal of whatever, right? So I'm gonna go, I'll come back. And that was kind of how that went. So, but then I was very much, after that, I had crossed the event horizon. I was in this group. And then he systematically went about breaking down any ties. So, I mean, later on, much later, I spent time actually reading Robert J. Lifton's book on the psychology of totalism in China. And read accounts of how they extracted confessions, false confessions from people. And it was just like that. Exactly like that. I'm not saying it is exactly like that in every cult, but it definitely was in our case. I had to write a letter to my fiance breaking things off with her. He would come back again and again and ask if I had counted the cost of making the decision that I had made. So once I had sort of come within the realm of this, I've said an event horizon, but not to overdo the phrase, but in the realm of this small group, which was now five people, four people and him, one of the people was me. So five total.
And so for you, just to clarify that, Event Horizon really is when you got on board the plane.
Yep.
And then you were destined yourself to be with this one man and this small group of people.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Yeah. So, but he was a freeloader. He lived in his brother's basement in suburban Maryland. You know, like literally any old suburban development. Like, that is what it looked like. You imagine the houses all roughly looking the same and the white picket fences and the big backyards. Like, that's what it was. And there was a furnished basement. He was in it. And then we were in it. There's just the four of us plus him. So
five altogether.
Right. Mm-hmm. One was a young woman. She and one of the young men were the two that were from my college. And they were a year or two younger than me, but they were there and it was my brother and it was me. My brother, he had to miss his like Ivy League graduation. It's like a big freaking deal. He skipped that and instead went to this. So we were all there and kind of thinking through and getting to know mentally the people that we would be going to see. You know, who are these people? And kind of like if you imagine like a Mission Impossible scene or something, right? And they're like trying to memorize all the dignitaries that they'll be seeing, right? Like that kind of thing. We would be going to live with a small, tightly knit community that he grew up in, right? His family and others, neighbors and such, right? So he knew them, and so we were memorizing things, right? We were also learning little, tiny little bits and pieces of their language, you know? We were also learning from his extended family who had migrated to the US. But I still have social anxiety from this time because, and other times with him, because he would have these weird social expectations of, he was like trying to socialize us into this, right? And so one of these things where I figured, look, the guy's methods are unconventional, but the idea is he genuinely wants us to be able to acclimatize, to get used to the culture that we're going to. He genuinely wants that. And so this is his way of doing it. And he's a little bit rough around the edges and a little weird. And he would say that, you know, he would say, look, this is like a military operation. Sometimes I might get a little harsh. You know, sometimes I might be, because it's because I care so much, you know, it's because this is important stuff. And it's because, you know, there are going to be times when you're out on the mission field and this is going to matter, right? You need these people to feel like you're one of them. They need you to feel like you're one of them so that they can accept your message, Jesus's message, right? Like, and Jesus spoke to me, right, to, in the sense of converting me, right, him. And, like, this is basically the way I choose to do things, right? So, you know, it kind of made sense, right?
But here's somebody who does say, look, you've done this far. You guys have made sacrifices to come this far. You've asked for assistance. We're all getting geared up. And, hey, it may get a little strange here, but it's because I care and because this is directly from God that it's probably better just to play along here. This is for the purpose.
Right, right.
So he's bracketing any critical thought that says, you mean I'm supposed to do what? Like if you have that thought, he has already given you a preset answer.
Always a step ahead.
Okay.
I want to just for a moment make something very clear. A huge, important dynamic of a cult. Very important. Once you're past that point of no return and you're inside the cult, the way they get you is to stop reality testing or truth testing. So the point of it is that you don't really get to question whether something makes sense or is true. And without getting a chance to question that, then it's true.
Everything is true.
It's not, I also say this very often, right? It's not a matter of me believing everything. It's a matter of me suspending disbelief on everything, right? I was not sort of like, this was all within a, sort of within a, I would say the plausible zone from certain wings of Christianity, right? He wasn't coming out and saying some kind of super crazy dogma. That's not what it was about. But you weren't really able to test your thinking whether it made sense or not.
And that seems important. So it's not as if you're not capable of critical thinking at that time. It's just the idea that you should think critically never gets triggered, because you're just doing what your job is right now. And he's already bracketed to say, this may fall outside some of your sensibilities, but this is what we're going to do. So it just never comes up to go, should I sit around and examine these ideas? That's not really what's on the table. Because I think there could be someone who puts somebody in these situations that really doesn't have the ill intent, but is still doing something quite wrong, which is, like you said, doesn't give the opportunity to do truth testing, to do reality testing, which is what all of us should be able to do as we go through life, in regards to our politics, to our family, to every dynamic we're a part of. We should be able to stop and go, hold on a minute, what's going on here? Let me just reflect. You're now in a social situation where reflecting is, it's kind of unnecessary. We're just going to bypass that.
Yes.
We're just going to do something else. I think that can happen for better and more nefarious reasons. Because I think a lot of us think, look, if I was there, I would think myself through this and not do that or be better. Or we even say to ourselves, if I was in Nazi Germany, I would not be a Nazi. But most people in Nazi Germany were. And something happens in us to get us collaborating and cooperating into moving certain directions that we think we're immune from, but people apparently aren't, especially people with a degree in philosophy who also speak Spanish, who has every ability to think critically. That's not the issue. It's not your ability to think critically that leaves you vulnerable in this position. It's that we're now in a social situation in which thinking critically is very cleverly suspended altogether.
Yeah, I often think about the conformity experiments of Solomon Asch.
Yes.
Yeah. Where he brought people in to look at a screen and say which of these lines is shorter than the others. And everybody in the experiment was a Confederate except for one. And everybody who was in on the experiment all said that it was the wrong one. And the one person was looking at it and is very likely to say, yeah, I guess you're right. It's the wrong one. If there was just one person who broke ranks with the rest of them, the percentage of people who will tell the truth goes way up. And so in this scenario, it's just you and the rest of the group. And you look around and all the other people are going along with it. All the other people are not really questioning it. They are, you know, it seems normal to them, or it seems like it seems normal to them, and so you go with it. But of course, all of them are thinking the same thing about you.
It's probably more complicated than that.
Hello, let me tell you just briefly about my little shop on Etsy. It's called Doug Thy Neighbor, as in Doug Thy Neighbor as thyself, because Doug rhymes with love. I really didn't think that through enough in advance. But I have these great t-shirts that are very heart and love oriented, and they're gender non-specific, and they're waiting for you to purchase them. They are affordable. They are beautiful. And I'm really happy if you'd buy my art and take it home with you, and you are supporting the work of the Heartburn Podcast. Thanks for stopping by. That's etsy.com/shop/ Doug Thy Neighbor. And that's Doug Thy Neighbor as thyself. You get the idea. Doug Thy Neighbor. Because it rhymes with love, and that's like super clever, right?
Probably more complicated than that.
I want to talk for just a minute about what it means to listen to Darren's story with love and what we can do to let it be exactly as complex as it actually is. When my guests come on my podcast, I promise them that I want to have honest, frank conversations, even if those conversations are really hard. I also promise them that I'm not really interested or willing to include lurid or sensational details for their own sake. When we experience the impact of shocking or sensational information, whether it's the news or on a podcast or in our own real lives, our minds tend to distance ourselves from that information. That makes sense to me, because if we're deeply empathized with every tragedy or sensational story that we heard, we just wouldn't be able to function. One of the easiest ways to push stories away from us is to oversimplify the situation or to criticize the people in it or quickly judge those who are involved. That's what our brains naturally do, and we do it because it's a way of staying mentally safe. So clearly there's an appropriate time for that. But this podcast, it was created so that when we know we're safe, as I trust you are now, when we're free to listen to a podcast or going out for a walk, doing the dishes, we can come back to the difficult issues and we can listen more closely with compassion, kindness, and empathy, and of course, most importantly, love. But instead of pushing a story away, love has a way of bringing the story closer to us, closer to our own lives, and it allows us to compare the similarities, the patterns, and even the warning signals in our own stories, past, present, and future. And interestingly enough, when we develop love and compassion for the people in this story, we also develop the capacity for love and compassion for ourselves. When we listen to others with love, we become capable of looking at our own lives with love as well. And that's something that criticism and judgment alone can't do. So love is not merely an affect or a sensation or an emotion, but when we honestly practice the hard work of love, including empathetic listening, we become open to things that we might otherwise never have given a second thought. Here at The Heartburn, love not only makes giving hard things a second thought possible, it makes it possible for us to discover that there may be things about us that need to change. And it makes us willing to change. And I also sincerely believe that it makes that change in us possible. Let's go back now to Darren's story and listen, perhaps, just a little more closely and with love. Yes. And so one of the things that somebody could do at this point is to say, oh, I'm smarter than that. And then and to think, because I'm smarter than that, they don't actually pay attention and do the things to protect themselves from groupthink in different situations. Or they might say, this is just a problem with religion. But then along comes a cult that talks about itself as being a non-religious group.
Right.
And you're susceptible again. So I like that you say that you have to follow your gut because there's something holistic. And that's not as vague as it may sound initially. Your gut is one way of talking about all of my senses cooperating together to give me an instinct or to give me a signal, yes or no. And it means it's my critical thought. It's my memories of what's past. It's how the thing smells. Does this smell right to you? Is a holistic way of thinking. With our brains, we call it our gut. So we will also be linking to Robert J. Lipton's Totalitarianism Studies, his book, and some of the interpretations and use of that by Stephen Hassan, who is famous for working in deprogramming stuff, and is controversial himself. But they will have lots to say about what are the patterns that you can see. But then there's a whole different, I think, I have a series of questions we won't address in this moment, but about how to form a better gut.
Mm.
What are the kinds of things, what are the relationships that we have? What practices do we put in that ensures that I have a regular taste for critical thinking as part of my prayer life, as part of my spiritual life? So that if that disappears, I end up hungry again. That I there's something in my gut that says, I'm missing something. So that's a whole different set of questions for us to come to, but that's why I wanted to get some clarification. What's the next big step for you? Not chronologically per se, but what's the next big milestone that where you think you've leveled up or you realize you're further in to this? Or
so after we've been in Maryland for quite some time now, and we're getting used to the new normal, which, as you said, is kind of a qualitative break from everything before, we go to interesting thing that happens. He decides that he's not going to go with us. It's just the four of us going to, and he is staying stateside. Now, none of us really know why that is. I suppose I could ask around if any of us remembers that. I certainly don't. He had some supposedly legitimate reason, right? But nobody really knows. So the four of us went to, you know, never having been to that part of the country. Four of us in our early 20s. You know, what is happening here? Very, very different. I mean, vastly different. We wore different clothes. It was hotter than I ever remember it being ever. I think hotter than here, which is saying something. And, you know, we flew from where we were in Maryland to JFK to Switzerland to Dubai, and from there and on gigantic planes that I'd never been on before. And our luggage was lost. And we were taken in by people we never knew. And everything was weird.
And there's no internet for you just to hop on and talk to other people.
No, there were internet cafes, maybe, mm-hmm. You know. But like, this isn't a time when everybody had like cell phones. They could be sort of on all of that. That wasn't a thing. So, and when we got there, eventually, when we settled in, we were staying with his family. Specifically his mother and father and little brother who stayed behind with his parents. They're in a rather large home. They had kind of like a two-family setup that they owned themselves, like two buildings, really nice buildings, and we got one of them. So so that's where we stayed for a summer. And the next big thing that happened was the abuse, physical abuse, you know? And I truly believed that he had an intuition about what we were thinking or saying or doing, you know? I believed that. And so it's not like, for me anyway, being sort of having grown up in an evangelical world where I was a pretty religious guy and believing the best in people and all of this, like I didn't think like it made sense for me to kind of like, I never even really rebelled from my parents, like it didn't really make sense for me to like think that I should think anything other than that I should go with whatever he was saying. You know, especially if he knew, if God was telling him in his heart what was going on. This made for some really interesting bad things, especially what happened when he first told me to punch my brother. So just to be really clear, what I'm saying is that the abuse happened when he wasn't even there physically. Much later on, when we were sort of deprogramming and like after facilities and such, like we literally had a sociologist come and ask us questions because her whole thesis was built around the fact that the leader had to be there. They don't, right? But he told me to punch my brother in the jaw. And what happened in this moment was I look at my brother and he looks at me like, well, what are you gonna do? It's time to punch me in the jaw, right? Like you expect in that moment to look at your sibling and think that they're gonna look at you like you have 14 heads. Like, are you kidding me? Like, let's get out of here. And that's not what he did at all. He looked at me like a lamb to the slaughter. Time to do your job. You know, this is apparently the agreement that this guy has with my brother is that he's physically punished. What the f***? How's this supposed to happen in a... What? Did not make any sense to me. But I'm looking at my brother that I've known at that time for 20-odd years, and he's expecting me to punch him. Okay, okay. So I punch him, you know. And because I've gone back over that obviously quite a few times in my life, wondering like what happened here? But that's what happened, you know. There was an expectation that I would follow through. And from there it devolved. Those things happened more often. They happened to the point where by the end of the summer, I remember once I was told, and I don't want to go to the lurid, so maybe I shouldn't. But
I can edit.
Yeah, but it got to where you could tell lurid stories if you wanted, right? It was bad. I'm not proud of those things, you know, but I really hurt him a lot, my brother. And at the time it was just me and my brother. Like he wasn't expecting us to hurt each other, sort of like these other people, I don't know, I knew them from college, but like there are these dynamics with your sibling where maybe there's latent sibling rivalry, maybe there's sort of like leftover issues from childhood of, you know, who knows what, right? But those things can be milked. There are engines that are kind of there, but like maybe you don't do that with somebody you don't know from college.
To me, I can see though, even as you say now, I'm not proud of that. If you're saying that now, one can imagine from the very first time that you strike your brother, it's that much harder to leave or to think differently because then you're just a guy who's hit your brother who now questions the whole framework that set you up
exactly.
For this.
Exactly.
It's a bit like dealing with the mafia in the sense that, you know, you do one thing and you owe them a debt and then you're caught up into a whole network of obligations and self-doubt and now it means you, and if you turn us in, we're going to turn you in, and you're complicit in this. And what that does to a person's self, to your gut, to your brain at that time, is hard for anybody not in that situation to imagine. But what we know just from the data, it's powerful.
It's absolutely powerful. The further in you go, the more questioning any little thing means that the whole thing is a damn house of cards. And all of these things that you did mean nothing. And yeah, they mean that you just hurt somebody a lot. For what? And so what, are you going to question those little things? Because it's going to question everything. And it's hard, and it's powerful. We came back from, and eventually, the physical abuse became more pervasive, and involved more of us, all of us, except it was different with the one young woman in the group. It was still bad. It was still psychologically very damaging, but he just took it out in different ways because he sort of wanted to window dress for purity culture. I remember once having to pull my brother's hair out. And I remember much later, after we were out, he asked me why, like, dude, he couldn't even see you at that point. We both remembered what we were talking about. Like, why did you pull so hard? Like, if anything, he would know that you were pulling, fine. But you pulled extra hard. And for me, the reason was I was pulling so hard because I felt this so much. I was pulling to it was like I was trying to pull out my feelings. Like, you know, like make it hurt less if I just pulled extra hard. I wouldn't feel how much this was horrible.
It's probably more complicated than that.
Hello, let me tell you just briefly about my little shop on Etsy. It's called Doug Thy Neighbor, as in Doug Thy Neighbor as Thyself, because Doug rhymes with love. I really didn't think that through enough in advance, but I have these great t-shirts that are very heart and love oriented, and they're gender non-specific, and they're waiting for you to purchase them. They are affordable, they are beautiful, and I'm really happy if you'd buy my art and take it home with you, and you are supporting the work of the Heartburn Podcast. Thanks for stopping by. That's etsy.com/shop/DougThyNeighbor. And that's Doug Thy Neighbor as Thyself. You get the idea. Doug Thy Neighbor. Because it rhymes with love, and that's like super clever, right? It's probably more complicated than that. Again, it's more complicated than just saying, don't ever be part of a community. That's a disastrous response to this and other stories, is that that's not how humans thrive. So... So that raises questions. Well, the pressing question everybody kind of wants to know at this point is, now we can see at this point you are participating in a way, in some ways for your own sanity, you're participating with enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yes. For some semblance of sanity. It's mm-hmm. like, so I feel sane, even though I know this is insane.
You're regularly hurting each other.
Yes. Yeah.
How do you get out? What makes this sort of a thing stop?
Well, in our case, it was an intervention. It was multiple interventions. One intervention that got my brother out. Another intervention to get me out. I was the last to leave. And there were other parts of the story as well. At the end of every day, we would see him. At the beginning of every day, we were with him. And we would go out and be out in the world. But at the end of every day, we were with him. And he would question us and ask us what happened during the day. And we would go through it. And if he felt some slight tinge of hesitation on anything, he would ask about that. And frankly, interrogate us. And if when he interrogated us, if he thought there was more that we weren't saying, he would go there relentlessly and viciously.
This is back in Maryland.
Yeah, back in Maryland.
So you're not even doing quote-unquote mission work on the field at this point. It's later. Part of the whole, but this is actually post first trip to...
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So, you know, we were out and about, and at the end of the day, though, we would get these interrogation sessions, which were very much like any interrogation session anywhere, right? And so you knew, this is the important part, if you're out and about and you're talking to somebody or you're doing anything, you know that this moment you are in is going to come up in an interrogation. This conversation you're having, this thought you're having, is going to be the subject of an interrogation. So by God, you better not be thinking something that you might not want to have to talk about in that interrogation, because that could be brutal and honestly exhausting, and it could involve physical pain, it could involve humiliation, it could involve isolation, it could involve extreme cold, it could involve any of the above. And so don't think it, whatever it is. So that's when I talk about like not reality testing, I'm talking about like really severely, no, you don't get a chance to do reality testing, is the way that that ended up going. So for a while we were teaching. During that time, I mentioned my brother and I were teaching and he was teaching, but the other two people were not. They were doing other things like praying and raising prayer from churches. The way we would do that is like combing through the internet, sitting in a library somewhere, because that's the only place you had the internet, right? Going through, because we didn't have like web crawling technology, we would just go through and like literally copy down websites, email addresses from churches and phone numbers. We would copy down this information from churches, and then that way we could get a hold of them and ask them to pray for these people. For some reason, that was his obsession. Instead of getting money, he wanted to get fame in terms of prayer. So while they were doing that, and they would always be together, one day she had to go to the bathroom. So he stood watch at the convenience store while she went to the bathroom. And while she was in there, he suddenly had a thought. I could leave right now. I wouldn't have to go back and see him at the end of the day. Like, I could end this nightmare right now. And that's what he did. So he left. And then, funny thing, she got out of the bathroom. He's gone. He's gone. I could leave right now. I could end this nightmare. I wouldn't have to go back and see him at the end of the day. None of this would happen. Like, it would be over. I could see my family and I'd be a happy person again. So she left too. So we now went from 5 to 3. And the three were me, my brother, and this guy. She wanted to get us out. She wanted to, you know, stop this nightmare for everybody. So she went to the church that we were part of. She went to them and brought all of her allegations of these are the things that were happening. She brought that to them and they decided that they would make a, I don't know, this is like a church tribunal or what's what we're looking for, right? To bring us in and ask questions. Well, for a long time, he said that we should just tell the truth. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is wonderful. I was so relived. Like, it's just the truth is going to come out and whatever happens, happens. This is what I've always wanted. But then he changed his tune at some point and decided that we should deny everything categorically. And I'm like, how does that even make sense, man? Like, really? You should come up with some lie that's like close to the truth or something. Don't deny it categorically, because this guy who's in charge of the church, the pastor and others, you know, they had like three people who would be asking questions. They're not going to believe that. They're going to say, like, character-wise, why would this girl make this stuff up if none of it was categorically anywhere close to true? So why would you have us do that? Like, none of this made sense. But, you know, I don't know. I went in and I just told them that everything was false. Now, I did that fully expecting that these people had a brain and that they would see through it, that they would basically, like, you know, like, blink twice if he's holding you captive type of thing. Like, I thought that they would be like, okay, obviously there's something going on. You know, if they're denying everything, something's wrong and we're going to step in. They didn't step in. They didn't say right then, we're going to keep you here and bad guy guru, you can go home. We're going to hold on to them for a little longer. We're going to let them see their families. We're going to do whatever. They didn't do any of that. They were like, I don't know. It's a he said, she said thing. I don't know. Maybe she's right. Maybe she's wrong. What the hell just happened? It was the most defeating thing in my life to date. Like, even after everything that had happened, I thought that maybe the church, any church community, maybe they would speak for the little guy, believe the little guy, girl in the not a little girl, but, you know, who got hurt badly by a predator in their midst, maybe they would sort of see through that, do something about it? No. And so that was horrible, right?
So just the default presumption of innocence before guilty is something rhetorical that's important for our legal system. That's not important for all of our relationships. In fact, right. We have to have a certain amount of faith in when people express concerns for their own safety or someone else's. And thankfully, there are these cultural moments, but we're only in the transition moment. It doesn't mean that we're there. So churches, friends, people groups need to get better at learning how to confront and how to ask questions and how to ask them well, how to follow up, how to invest, how to provide outs for each other. So there's a lot for us to be done. Cult problems are not problems for a select few in the universe. Though this doesn't happen all the time everywhere, and we don't want to force paranoia. What we want to do is really encourage people to get skilled at taking care of each other and looking out for each other and not letting people disappear into these sorts of situations. And how to look out and how to trust yourself and look out for yourself and how to ask for help. Those are things. So it's about as horrific as you can get, that you can be somewhere where something is so obviously wrong and there's an opportunity for assistance and it just gets bypassed altogether. Learn to ask the right questions, learn to be concerned. Yes. And paranoia doesn't help here. It'll drive us in the wrong direction, but genuine care and concern and trust, especially people who are the ones at risk, absolutely, not the one who is in power. That person's not the one to favor in these situations. Even when there's false claims, we need to get good at sussing those out, not let more people be abused. That's where we need to do our work. And this means nobody falls outside the umbrella of needing to work harder at making sure that that's not the society we live in. Everybody. So this isn't a story just about how not to be part of a cult or even what's wrong with religion or what's right with whoever helped you get out. This is a story about us all learning to take better care of each other, at least, at its very minimum, it's that.
Yeah, because I guarantee you, if there is a person that you look up to, that you think you want to presume their innocence, that they are a good person, that they're in a position of power, that they are likely benevolent, and you don't want to accuse them of that, imagine the person that they could be hurting right now or could have already hurt They had that same presumption of innocence. They trusted that person. They believed that that person was not going to hurt them, that they had their best interests at heart. And that person didn't. And you need to hear that voice and understand that they could not be the person you think they are. Because that person learned that the hard way. So
here we are today. And maybe for the first time in a very long time, you're making some efforts to reconstruct a faith or a spirituality undefined at this point.
Sure.
But what is that? I mean, I want to just leave it as open as what is that like, but I have lots of questions, which is, where does it become difficult? What's the things that makes it difficult? And I know that it's too big of a bite to take, but hey, look, is faith still possible? Let's just start there. Some kind of faith still possible.
Yeah. Well, maybe. I don't know. Jury's still out. I think so. I really enjoyed the movie The Polar Express. But I love the characters. I love the story of it. And you know, there's this hobo on the train, right? And it's the story of this kid who is trying to recover his sense of faith in Santa Claus, which is, you know, different topic maybe. But, you know, he's trying to recover faith is the point. And it's a story about that, right? And the hobo is the cynic in the story, right? And he's on the train. And he says, you don't want to be led down the primrose path. You know, you don't want to be bamboozled. And he's like, I get you, kid, you know. And that is to some extent how it feels after something like this. Absolutely, right? Like, I remember after all of this being sort of deeply emotionally manipulated and reading Paul, one of his letters to Timothy, you know, and he's like, I remember with tears your mother and whatever, whatever. And I was like, screw you. You know, like, I felt like this was Paul laying it on thick on this poor kid, Timothy, you know, and maybe a little bit of projection of my own story on there, right? But I'm like, how do I believe any of this, right? And for a long time, I explained it as I also really enjoyed the movie The Matrix. And like, there's this scene where, Cypher, the guy who ends up like betraying everybody, right? He's talking to the agents and it's over a fake stake. The premise of the movie is that none of this is actually real. They're all up. It's all digital and they're all actually sort of being manipulated and kept down, right, in the system by androids, whatever. Anyway, the point is, he's eating the steak and he's like, you know, sometimes I just wish I could believe that this was really steak. And that's a lot of the ambivalence that I've felt after things like this have happened, is that, like, I know how all of this can be milked and all of these engines can be used, social engines can be used in the service of evil. I know how it can all be manufactured by humans. I know how it is rife with problems. So how can I just go back to sort of uncritically just do-do-do, just yay, go God, you know, like, it's hard. I cannot, it is, I believe, categorically impossible to recover the exact same faith that I had before. I can't do that. So I have done what I can to try to remain open to spiritual experience and to also set some safeguards for myself. Like, I say to myself, well, I definitely want to make sure that I can always ask questions, you know, and this goes back to even sort of my pre-cult evangelical days. There are things that I just wouldn't ask questions about because, you know, then my whole belief system would sort of fall apart. You know, I didn't want that. So I want to make sure that if there's anything that I go to, like, I'm able to ask any question I want. It's not like intellectually straitjacketing me or tethering me to anything. So I try to set up boundaries for myself. And I am so very sensitive to that being led down the primrose path thing. Like, I do not want to be seen in that way in any way. So, like, even when I do have sort of a spiritual experience, like, I don't post about it on Facebook or anything, right? Like, I don't want anybody to think that I'm going down that way, you know? No, but what I do try to do is I find that there are experiences for me, like reading poetry, or like reading certain books, just thinking deeply and meditatively, that bring me closer to who I want to be, because there's so much I don't want to lose that was wonderful about my life before my cult experience. So much. There was a lot I loved about the church, about my religious practice. You know, I loved being thoughtful and prayerful and meditative, and I loved having sort of a ready-made community everywhere I went, you know? I loved a lot. So I try to see if there are ways to recapture that. One of those was how we met. You know, I went to a festival here, and that was sort of like a safe thing for me, because it wasn't like, it wasn't something where you had to be a holy roller to go. You know, you didn't have to have any commitment to any one particular creed or group, you know, and or any particular creed or group. You know, I could just go, just check it out. So I did, and then I didn't have any other thing to go to. I happened to go to your workshop there, and I was like, oh, that's about prayer. I don't know. You know, I guess I'll check it out. but there are some wonderful things, and that I found, and I've been able to experience wonder, and experience some of those spiritual elements that I miss.
How does the Polar Express turn out?
The girl who's sort of the other hero, I think they actually literally call them Hero Boy and Hero Girl in the credits, right? She can hear a sleigh bell, or the sleigh bells of Santa Claus. And she can hear them because she believes in Santa Claus. And he doesn't really believe in Santa Claus. And so he doesn't hear them. And he's kind of bummed. You know, it's like, I don't hear them. I don't hear them. And then in the end, it's Santa Claus himself who calls him up for the first gift of Christmas, you know, and he hands him one of the sleigh bells, or the kid asks for a sleigh bell and he gives him the sleigh bell, and he shakes it and he can't hear it. And then he says to himself a few times, I believe, I believe, I believe. And then he hears it. And he's like, oh my gosh, I heard it, you know? And so in the end, he does this sort of monologue, as you know, afterward, about how he, you know, still believes in Santa Claus. So that's roughly how it ends.
So here you are now. What is one thing that, at least as best as you can, could say, here's one thing I hear from God. Here's one thing I think is true about God, or that I've learned about God, whatever that, knowing that's still largely undefined. What can you say about God after all this experience and with all the work that you've done and all that has happened up till today?
But I have a poem, you know, that to me, like, came to mind at a time when I was really thinking about how can I think of the presence of God, or who God is, or what, you know. The poem's called Lost. It's by David Wagoner.
It is our practice to always express appreciation here, not in the form of a love bomb, so that we will continue to appreciate you over time. But, you know, one of the things that I have appreciated in knowing you, and you demonstrated again here today, really on behalf of others. So there's a sense of love in this, but you do exercise great courage to tell the story again, but to tell it with the amount of grace for yourself and for others that you do, that the where there could be a lot more vitriol and bitterness in tucked in places where it isn't, is a gift to be able to listen to it and still learn from it. I appreciate the constant amount of joy, the amount of laughter that you have in telling this own story that is important, I think, to surviving any sort of thing that keeps us from faith. Laughter is usually part of pounding the way back to God. The laughter helps to pound the path back to God. And I do very much hope that wherever your faith journey ends up taking you, that it brings you people that and relationships that you have well earned, people like yourself that would readily intervene, that you have the ongoing courage to readily intervene for other people, but that you will have a sense of critical thinking, trustworthy community, willing to hold you up to recognize your actual tenderness for what it is, for your giftedness for what it is, and your incredible intuition to help you use that to be a blessing to others and not to take something away. And that I hope that somewhere, as a kind of sleigh bell, that one day we might know what God heard when he was around the corner manipulating your brother to help you have an experience that made you open your heart to God in a certain way. It's my prayer that you will know what God heard from you in that moment. Listen with me now as Darren reads Lost by David Wagoner.
Stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here, and you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and be known. The forest breathes. Listen. It answers, I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again, saying, here. No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a bush does is lost on you, you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you.
In order to record this last bit of commentary for the podcast, I had to remove a mouth guard, a mouthpiece that helps me keep from grinding my teeth from stress and anxiety, mostly because of my job. That, in truth, is not a job I really want to shape my life, let alone get to the point where it causes me to grind my teeth. But nevertheless, I've lived within the confines of that job for the last 11 years. And while I have done my best to think critically about my place there, I can honestly say that it seems like there are forces that discourage certain kinds of dissent and critical thinking within my job. And I have to ask, why do I comply? Meanwhile, we're in the early part of a presidential race where there's this gaggle of wildly imperfect people who will vie for the allegiance of the American populace. And any kind of landslide election or obvious victory is wildly unlikely, as our country is pretty effectively split down the middle right into two fairly equal parts, a red part and a blue one. Both with members who have sworn their allegiance to their party, and it's many more people than we imagine. It's most of us. Because that party has also become not just ideas, but our culture. It's our identity. And culture is much harder to question than just a platform or some plans and ideas on their own merits. It's not just our politics that are at stake, but our identities. It's who we are. And while many of us will passionately relish using different kinds of logic for critiquing and even insulting the people from that other team, whatever it may be, no single thread of reason will sustainably question how this red and blue works together to shape our imagination and keep us from asking the bigger, more prevalent questions. And more importantly, how does this red and blue divide keep us from coming together to do some of the good in the world that's urgently needed to be done? The degree of disdain and vitriol shared between family members alone will challenge some of our best relationships. And most of it's based on incorrect or incomplete or poorly framed information. So, what do we have to learn from Darren? If even for a moment while listening to him, you thought, oh, I would never do that. I could not possibly stoop to the position of dot, dot, dot. Then please consider just how many givens we uncritically accept for this and every election, for our paychecks, for our ongoing consumption of technology, or to just put a Band-Aid wherever what is so lonely inside of us today. What I want you to know is that I get that. I get it. I understand. And I genuinely want us to do better. So for me, it's impossible to listen to Darren's story, especially the parts where the indicators which normally tell us to start using logic and critical thinking fail. Without asking how I'm already participating in this proverbial matrix mythos, in what ways have I ever considered practicing some kind of dissent or even resisted the notion that things are not exactly what they seem? See, I can work to make myself feel safe by distinguishing who I am from Darren, or I can seize this moment to ask the hardest questions, even if it means I might be living in a house of cards. So here I am. What can I do to broaden my imagination? What can I do to see more clearly, to see more beautiful and life-giving possibilities? Well, if you are hoping I have a simple answer, all I can say is it's probably more complicated than that. But I can recommend to us a few really powerful directions to move. I know that I can always trust the ongoing work, hard work of love and reconciliation. And I can commend to you the value and importance of just making art and engaging art wherever you can and taking it seriously, no matter how sudden or amateurish it might initially seem. Listen, just listen to it. And I recommend dissent, not for its own sake or for the invention of a new persona of being a great dissenter and a heroic figure, but for the willingness to try to build a better society, a better group of people, to try to inspire love in those who seem loveless, and to try to do what is right and good, even if it never catches on, even when no awards await us, even if few people even notice. I recommend we tread the path of love, especially when no such path has yet been trod. I commend to you love. And I might be entirely wrong about all of this, but I'm willing to die trying. Hi, this is Doug Harrison. And isn't it time you felt your heart burn?